listening to Ding Dong Darkness Time Season 2, Stephen King Boogaloo. I gathered several of my most well-read friends together to discuss many of our favorite works by the master of the macabre himself. If you like what you hear, tell the world. In the meantime, let's talk some scary stories. Oh, and beware the spoilers, folks. They're a doozy. Welcome back to Ding Dong Darkness Time. This is part two of the discussion of Stephen King's Pet Sematary with author James D.F. Hanna. And we left off at probably the darkest turn of the book. So if you have not listened to part one of the episode, I highly recommend you go back and check that out before continuing with this one. And I hope you enjoy. King spares no opportunity to lay out the graphic details of this death, but he does it in such a way that, like, he doesn't lay it out all at once. It's just little details brought up. So he talks about the little boy's shoes being ripped off. He talks about his jumper being turned inside out. And he talks about the baseball cap lying in the road full of blood. And when you're reading about this in the context of a toddler, it's like being stabbed over and over again.
King talked about this. I remember reading somewhere that he had the realization, because it's interesting in that first section of the book that you were talking about, which is really kind of like the first half of the book. The book divided into three sections.
Yes.
And that first section, there's a swath of book where, like, Gage gets sick. And you kind of know, I mean, like King said, he realized at some point in the book, he had to kill Gage.
That's a very interesting insight. I hadn't heard that, but that, I remember that, Gage being really ill, yeah.
And you have those chunks in the book where it's like Gage is sick, and you know, you don't know what's going to happen. Is, you know, did we introduce all of this, you know, road and truck traffic and everything, and then all of a sudden, oh, is this kid going to get wiped out by a fever?
Right.
You know, you're not sure what's going to happen because it is King. And I mean, you know, King at this point did not really necessarily have an issue with killing a kid.
No.
He was a fairly brutal, you know, writer still. I mean, he still can be, but yeah. You know.
But this was definitely during his leanest and meanest phase, absolutely.
Boom, you go into that second chunk of the book and you realize, you know, and Gage is dead, and then that's really, to me, so much of what makes this book great is that whole chunk of the book that we're getting ready to go into right now, mm-hmm. where the family is dealing with and processing all of the, you know, this death and the tragedy of it. And Rachel, you know, doesn't know how to deal with it. And Lewis definitely doesn't know how to deal with it. And there's the conflict with, you know, Rachel's family and so much conversation about, you know, sort of, you know, mortality and how we process and deal with death. And some of it is emotionally horrific. I mean, there's the obvious visceral, but there's just the heartbreak of parents mourning the loss of a child.
Yes.
You know, and because at this point, Gage is only two, and all of that is just heartbreaking. On the, you know, when you're reading it, and it's some of my favorite writing by King, honestly.
Like when Lewis talks about how he knew from the moment he saw the baseball cap in the road, what he was going to do. And then everything from that point is that thing that I mentioned earlier about Lewis trying to rationalize and use every bit of his doctor's clinical look at life to almost like justify his ultimate decision, which is, you know, and he thinks about it in these ways of like, how bad off would he really be if, you know, we brought it back? Sure, he'd be a little slow. Like he compares him to the cat. He'll be a little clumsy. He might need special, you know, have special needs or disabilities or whatnot. But we wouldn't love him any less. And then he goes in to talk about how they worried when Gage was a baby that he had hydrocephalus and what that would include, because his head was measuring much bigger than it should have at that age, and all the scare that they went through. And he applies that logic to this. We'd just be so happy to have him back. And he talks about how he would bring Gage back, and then he would take him down to Florida, and Lewis would get a job at Disney as a medic. And then he would bring Rachel and Ellie down and introduce them, and again, and they would just live happily ever after. And it's just a fucking delusion. And we know this on our basis as readers and knowing stories and how Stephen King stories might work, and how no. This is not going to work out the way you think it is, because we just know that on an instinctual level, but also on an emotional level. Like, if I knew there was even a chance, would I do it? And that is something that I think everybody who reads this story has to wrestle with, even if they're not going to wrestle to completion, because it's horrific to even consider, right? First of all, that level of loss, the loss of a child, especially a child so young, not that it's any easier when they're older by any stretch, but when you think about the loss of someone so young that didn't even have a chance to even try to have a life, I think you feel this inclination to want to restore that on some level. And then also the fact that this knowledge of this burial ground that brings things back from the dead is a huge, almost like a deadfall onto itself, blocking the path to dealing with grief and loss that we all have to go through. They talk about those seven stages of grief, right? Well, there's something blocking that path for Lewis. Blocking it even more so than it is for Rachel, because Rachel has no clue about any of this stuff, right? So she's actually on a more authentic journey. We're seeing that she's so lost in her fog of the moment that she can't even function. But when the book actually pivots to her POV a couple times, you get a sense that she's horrified, she's so heartbroken, she's so exhausted, but at the end of the day, she is still doing her best to get up for her one remaining child, and she is determined to go on and get up and go through the motions until maybe one day it doesn't hurt as much. Her process feels very natural for a lot of people, I think, going through something like this, whereas Lewis went from being Mr. Clinical, Mr. I understand death is natural. His trajectory is monstrous. And he grows colder, and he grows harder, and he grows more obsessed and determined to do this deed. And he becomes very frightening over the course of all that. So it's really interesting that.
Lewis is very much, I think, the villain of the story.
Oh, for sure.
You completely, and it's why, like, the movie is interesting. We'll talk about that because I have thoughts.
Oh, sure. Yes.
But it's why it's interesting, because he is very much, he's described as being very sort of like old-fashioned, blue-eyed America. He's 6'2" and good-looking and whatnot. And he has a conversation with Judd, where it's like, well, have they ever buried a human being in the pet cemetery? And Judd's like, no, that's craziness. Of course not. But wait, there's more. But then, as he's progressing, Lewis, because Rachel has how she dealt with grief with all of the backstory with her sister Zelda,
Oh, yeah.
Oz the Great and Terrible,
Oh, dear
which
God.
is all horrible, all just like, and it's amazing to me, like, one of the things that King does is he will very often have characters telling the story themselves,
Yes.
and so you just got these giant swaths of dialogue,
Mm-hmm.
And Rachel is, Rachel tells that story about, the night her sister died. And because her sister had spinal meningitis. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it's absolutely horrific, when she's describing it.
Yes.
And when Judd tells a story later about Timmy, also horrific. But also such great effective storytelling, because, they're very, Rachel's voice is very different from Judd's. But you do, I think you start to see, and I'm all over the place on this, so sorry about that.
Oh, you're fine.
You do very much see where Lewis is becoming the antagonist. I mean, when the story begins, he's very much the protagonist of the story. You think he's going to be the guy, who shepherds through. But ultimately, and because it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, as a culture, we don't deal with death well.
Right.
And Lewis obviously can't handle, doesn't know how to deal with it. And there are great passages later in the book where, he is quote unquote processing, and his processing is, I'm going to make the worst, the worst choices of my entire existence.
Yes.
And in those, he is very much, because he is unable to deal with death in a sane, healthy, rational manner, he loses that clinical side. He loses that ability to be dispassionate about it. He becomes the antagonist of his own story.
No matter how people try to intervene, like Judd, when Judd does come over the night after Gage's funeral and tells him the real truth about the person that was buried up there, the Timmy Baderman story, and what came back from that was no clumsy, slightly bloodthirsty cat. It was a shambling sack of evil. It was essentially the personification of whatever spoiled the ground up there. So, we have, like the fact that it knows things about everybody. So everybody that...
Love that part.
That struck fear into my fucking soul. Because the things that you guard, the things that are, your secrets, the things that you hold close, that something could just look at you and spell them out like that in the open and just lay them bare for everybody to gawk at or be laughed at is horrifying. And I don't know, I would have to think that for me, and I have the gift of retrospect and hindsight and whatnot, that after that conversation with Judd, I probably would put away the thought of, okay, I would believe my friend. I think I would be looking for an out, at that point. And he has one, but he just can't do it. He sets about his, what did he call it? I think he called it mad work or dark work, something like that. He systematically lies to his wife to get her out of town, to go back to Chicago with Ellie. And, even though Rachel, by this point, she's dealing with it. I mean, it is the worst harrowing nightmare of all time, but Rachel is dealing with it. She's feeling like she doesn't want to leave. She's already sensing something's up, that Lewis is losing it. She's thinking that Lewis is going to kill himself, which is a completely logical belief to have.
It's interesting because what Lewis does is he sends Rachel and Ellie back to Chicago with her parents after the really horrific...
Oh, fight scene at the funeral?
Yeah, the fight scene at the funeral. Which, I'm Appalachian. It's not like the first time I've seen a fight at a funeral. But it's really, really terrible the way it's described in the book.
Awful.
Because everything hints and flashes. And they knock the coffin over.
Yes.
And
yes.
You have this moment where you're just waiting for that coffin to pop open. And you're going to see, the horror that is, Gage. And thankfully, King does not. It's like there's like a hint of a pale skin or something like that.
He's saving us for that later on, right? And honestly, there are times when I have... anytime I'm feeling like I am not pushing the envelope hard enough, if I feel like I'm not getting truthful enough about something. I've returned to passages of this book because to me, it is like, would I be able to do this? Would I be able to tell this story to this level? And maybe you also maybe have your own insights into this, but ever since I've been sort of churned through the commercial publishing industry, especially mainstream commercial fiction, there is a certain level of tightrope that you have to walk in terms of how much you're allowed to describe, or they want you to describe, how visceral they want you to be about stuff. There's like this, it's almost like trying to thread the line between PG-13 and R in terms of, you know, ratings. And so, and sometimes it feels like putting a muzzle on yourself, and it can be very frustrating. And sometimes I'm wondering, am I sharing enough? Am I going far enough into this emotional journey? And should I hold back? And then I go and read the passages of that funeral scene, that fight scene. And I also read the grave robbing scene, because those I have specifically returned to that grave robbing scene. I, even without context, I won't even read the whole book. I'll just pull up that section of the book. Even though it's horrific to read, specifically because King not only did his homework on, you know, grave digging and, you know, how cemeteries work in a technical sense. This is not a classic movie where you go and you just dig up the coffin and you hit it with your shovel, right? It after you get 6 feet deep. No, you have to get past a concrete lid, because every cemetery, at least in America nowadays, they have grave liners or vaults that are buried. You put the coffin in the concrete vault. That's what gets buried, not just coffin and dirt, right? So I love that he adds that additional detail. Because Lewis's uncle in the book was an undertaker. And so he brings with him some of that knowledge.
Quiet trade.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Absolutely love that. And, you know, he refers a lot to his uncle and that the things that he learned from him. So, of course, you know, going through the painstaking process of watching Lewis break into the cemetery after dark. And there's some moments of like humor in it as well. Like the dog that keeps howling as he's like trying to be very quietly sneak in. And even Lewis is, there's like a passage or a quote that he talks about the limits of horror that the human mind can withstand before it basically starts looping back on itself, and where the sense of humor starts to come in. It's almost like you become mad and giddy with it because there's so much horror.
Yeah.
Like it's a really great exploration of why there are moments of humor in this section. It's almost like you need that. You need a little bit of that. So Lewis breaks into the cemetery. He buys his grave robbing tools right before he goes, and he goes through this whole procedure. And he threads his rope through the rings of the concrete liner, which he said he ordered specifically because a vault is sealed. Like you would need a jackhammer to get it open, essentially. Whereas a liner, the lid is just kind of dropped on top and then it's buried. It's not fully sealed. And he says specifically he chose this because he knew he would be going back in later. And so he goes into the grave, pulls the liner, we see the coffin, and he even just talks about the rocks that he hears hitting it as he's pulling the liner back. And he goes down into the grave, we see this tiny casket, and he opens it. And immediately, apart from the smell, immediately he believes Gage's head is gone. And this part is, but it's not gone. It's that his face has been covered in dark, like fungus, like mold because of the moisture.
Like moth. Yeah, like moth or something like that.
And so in that moment, you're just, it's so much horror on top of horror, right? So he just describes the sight of this child. And then he ends that chapter where he, after he lifts him up and he just is holding him and rocking him on the side of the grave. And I'm just like, I have to put the book down every single time and walk away for a while, because by that point, he's seeing Gage again as a live child. He is both angry, he damages the coffin, he's mad at it. He talks about how when he breaks it open, he scars the lock. It's not enough just to unlock the coffin. He wants to destroy it, which he does. And then he's already just holding this child who's been dead for well over a week at this point, I'm guessing. Oh my God. Just, oh my God. Right? But there's still such an emotional truth. It doesn't feel melodramatic. It doesn't feel gratuitous. It feels raw and very, very human and very, very unspeakable in that moment.
It feels very much like who King was as a writer at that time, because when he was writing this book, he must have been probably roughly the same age as Lewis was. So somewhere early 30s. And looking at his own kids and going back to why he had difficulty with this. That acknowledgement of having to deal with the impossible idea of losing a child. And it's probably it's interesting that you and I were similar ages reading this for the first time. And probably when we read it that first time, because, when you're 12, 13, 14 years old, you have nothing's intellectual at that point, but you have an idea of what terror is, of what horror is. So this is one of the things that I like, because I do think King just nails the terror of being a parent. My son's in college, and I get this phone call at like on a Friday night at 11:45, and I'm thinking, I remember what I would be doing at 11:45 on a Friday night, and I'm terrified. And so I answer the phone, and I'm like, "Hey, what's up?" He goes, "Hey, Dad, I'm in my dorm bored. Do you have Hulu? Do you have a Hulu password I could use?" And I'm like, "You asshole, why are you not out making regrettable choices right now? It's Friday night."
Right. But you get a call on a Friday night from your, yeah, that's
And
never
I
something
say
you
that
want to
I
see.
love my kid, obviously, but it is
Absolutely.
terror. It is absolute terror when you get phone calls from your kids, even as they are, quote unquote, young adults, that there is something bad, that there is something wrong, that something has happened.
My son did something very similar recently. He was up in Detroit for a concert with some friends. He's 19, and I was in bed, and it was about 2 in the morning or 1 in the morning when my phone starts ringing, and immediately I'm sitting up like, oh my God. And it was actually a number I didn't recognize, which made it even more terrifying. And I answer it, heart pounding, and it's DoorDash. Because my son used our DoorDash account to order some food at their Airbnb, and the DoorDasher was trying to find the entrance to the place. And of course, my number was attached to the account and not
Of
my
course.
son's. And so, and I'm like, oh my God, my son's, I am down in Ohio. I'm still trying to find my words. I'm awake. And in my head, I'm thinking, okay, oh my God. Because in that moment, yes, it's the first thing that enters your mind is my child is dead, my child is hurt, my child is, whatever. And just that icy moment alone is enough to put you into that place of like, I don't know what I would do. You would feel so lost on a cosmic level.
Extrapolate that to when your son was young. I mean, like, I remember my ex-wife, my kid's mother, I remember every fever that they ever had was nerve-wracking. Every time that they got sick, every time they had a stomach bug, everything was the when you're a young parent, everything about that is the most terrifying moment of your entire life, because, oh my God, what if there is something wrong that I can't fix?
Yeah, you feel
How
completely
powerless am
helpless
I?
in the moment. And this also reminds me too, I recently And the places that you're willing to go for your kids, right? And taking it back to when Lewis was on the edge of that grave, rocking his dead son, I was reminded I had read a very in-depth article on the death and the final years and the ultimate death of the lead singer of Alice in Chains, Layne Staley. And he had a horrible, horrible drug addiction that ultimately took his life, and it was slowly taking his life for many years before it finally did. And he became more and more reclusive as he grew less and less healthy and able to function, and to the point where people would go, weeks without hearing from him. That was a normal thing. So he was dead in his apartment for at least
Oh,
2 weeks
geez.
before they discovered him. Yeah, and they found him with his paraphernalia, it was an obvious overdose. And his mother, and this kills me. His mother came to the apartment and insisted on being let in, would not take no for an answer. And they let her in to sit beside her son, who had been dead for 2 weeks, while she talked to him. I can't even begin. I can't. I try to put my brain in that position, and I try to put one of my own kids in that place, and a wall goes up. I immediately, I'm like,
Yeah,
nope,
no.
not, but then to imagine the mother in this case. And then I think to myself, if I were her in that moment, I can only begin to imagine, would I, could I do that? And that is a woman that is not shying away from the realities of death. That is a woman who was staring it right
Yeah.
in its face. And that takes a level of bravery that I think most can't summon, but that's in some ways, I don't know. You never know until you're in that moment how you're going to react. And so, and Lewis by this point is completely lost in his own grief and his own delusion of where he's going and what this is going to bring him. By this point in the story, he's pretty damn well convinced that Gage is just going to come back to life,
Yeah.
right? Although it's really interesting. So, and again, comes second most terrifying part of the book for me. If we thought that the walk that he took with Judd to bury the cat was scary, imagine that same scene, but after you've had some really bad mushrooms. Like, it is super trippy, like off the
Yeah.
wall, terrifying. Lewis is already hurt, by the way, because when he climbed the fence to jump into the cemetery, he cracked his knee on a gravestone. And his knee is like super swollen, and he has many, many miles of tough walking to do through the woods and climbing. This is not an easy place to get to. What's terrifying, though, is after he's carrying Gage and he has his grave tools and he has Gage's body wrapped in a tarp, and he talks about the heaviness of it, and he talks about how concerned he is with making sure when he has Gage in the car wrapped up that he's facing forward, and just all these thoughts that go through Lewis's head that are just, King put himself there to have these thoughts that most people would not consider. I think a lesser writer would have made a much more watered down version of this. I'm not sure I could do it. I don't know that many people could, but he went there. He probably went there with the aid of some pretty wicked
Again, so
substances.
much
I think that's
coke.
what it would take.
So
So
much
much,
coke.
right? Yeah. And so when he's walking through the forest and he gets to the deadfall that's at the pet cemetery, the big pile of tree trunks and branches he has to climb to get past, normally this is a very dangerous pile of stuff. It's not, it shifts. You could fall in, you break your leg and impale yourself. But by this point, Lewis is being almost guided and assisted by the forces at work here. So he basically just sails up and down this deadfall like it's a staircase. And he's on the other side. And at this point, it's already been mentioned before that there's like sounds of mad laughter and, you know, other weird lights and things that are kind of attributed to like swamp gases and loons off the lake, you know, south of here. That's what Judd calls them. They're just the loons. But there's a little more to it than that, right? These are not birds. This is a very haunted piece of land. And Lewis has a bit of an encounter with a creature of legend, the Wendigo, which passes before him. And the Wendigo is part of Native American lore, but it's been used in a lot of cosmic horror contexts as well. And it's basically this wandering spirit. And whoever it touches is turned into a cannibal, essentially. But he sees this huge lumbering beast just kind of like pass before him, and he sees its footprint, and that's all you see of it. And you could just feel Lewis's sanity draining more and more away. It's almost like if you're in a video game, if you're playing like a game and your character gets poisoned and you could just see their life meter just very steadily draining away. That's almost what Lewis's sanity looks like at this point. He is staring madness.
I really like
in the face
horror, because this is the closest it gets to like that Lovecraftian concept of just like, it's almost too horrible to describe, but you will lose your sanity. And obviously Lewis loses his shit at this point. He doesn't lose his shit. He doesn't have like a big display or anything. He just, like, this is
right.
He loses whatever connection he still had.
And he's just cognizant enough to know this. And he's just standing there, almost like in a distant part of his mind, just watching it happen. And what's interesting is after he buries Gage up at the Mi'kmaq burial ground, he's cognizant enough again to know, because he's, again, the clinician, he has prepared his medical bag, his doctor's bag, the black bag that has all the goodies in it, first aid stuff. But he's also got some pretty strong drugs in there. He's got some vials of morphine, and he loads them up because he is still in his mind convinced that this is an experiment, because he says that if Gage comes back and he's not good enough, then I'm going to kill him again and rebury him.
Which
in
is what
his
a sane person would do, obviously.
Of course. Yeah. Forget all the previous
this
stuff.
This is what a totally sane person does. Is I'm going to resurrect my kid, and if I don't like him, I'll kill him again.
Yeah, right. And so he prepares these things. Well, King does not give us much chance to catch our breath, because Lewis is asleep. And then all of a sudden we see a shadow creep into the room, a shadow going for that medical bag, the shadow taking something shiny out of it, and then leaving in its wake muddy footprints, a bad stench, and those footprints are very small. And Lewis just sleeps through it. And that is also part of it, because there's a lot of other forces going on at the same time, right? This moment is intercut with some interludes. We have Judd, who's keeping watch, and we're in Judd's head for these parts. And Judd is reminiscing about his old days, and that's where we get some of the secrets of Judd's past and you know, just some of his the good old days kind of memories that he has as well. But he's slowly slipping away into sleep, because again, he's being lulled to sleep while the graveyard forces do what they're doing. And then on the other side of things, we have Rachel, and she's at her parents' house. She just got into Chicago, and Ellie is losing her mind because she has been seeing Victor Pascal, and who has been trying to warn her about what's going on. And Ellie is trying to convince Rachel that, you know, they have to go back, they have to go home. And Rachel finally listens to Ellie, because she knew something was up all along. But of course, in Rachel's mind, she's thinking it's all instinct. She's even going into psychological theory and stuff and remembering things from her own college professors and her own education studies as well. I did appreciate the trip into Rachel's perspective for this story. I felt like it was needed. in this bit, it just makes what happens later even more tragic, I feel. But she decides, okay, I'm going to go back home, keep Ellie at the grandparents' house. But she has a little trouble getting home, doesn't she? It seems like every attempt that she makes to get home is thwarted. She can't get a flight. She misses her connection. She has to rent a car. She's falling asleep on the road. The car breaks down. Every single, you know, bit of progress she gets is a setback.
The forces at play.
Because, yeah. And again, to evoke that cosmic horror sense, right? Because it is a force much greater than we know and that we understand. And you can feel that. I mean, honestly, it's got its fingerprints through the entire book. But this is when it's out and it's unmasked. And, you know, Rachel doesn't finally get a break to get home until it's too late. And honestly, Lewis doesn't wake up either until it's far too late. Because he's still asleep when Rachel pulls up and decides to go to Judd's
She had called Judd, which is why Judd was sitting there waiting.
Yeah. That's right. He said, come here first. Thank you. Yeah.
Because Judd knows.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have.
Yeah,
we'll
Judd
talk.
Knows that, yeah. that Lewis is making terrible life decisions.
And at this point, we already know Judd is dead because we see the final showdown between Lil Gage, who isn't really Gage, but just. Can we just stop here for a second, though? And we'll get to the movie in a sec, but we have to talk about the depiction in this book of this kid. And can you just imagine a 2-year-old
with a
scalpel
and the mouth on this
looking
kid.
Like, oh my, all the things that he's saying in his little baby voice. And not only that, he's completely misshapen and stitched back together. He looks like he's had a bad accident because he has. So this malformed, like little toddler sized demon, you know, it's like something you would see in like Spirit Halloween Store, you know, like those little devil babies. It's just like animatronic come to life. But Judd's encounter with this, the graveyard, essentially in the form of this kid. Is very harrowing, and you get the sense that Judd never really had a chance, and Judd knows the inevitability of
and what I love, I have to pull this because I showed you before we were talking before we started recording, you know, I made notes, and I love this part during this confrontation, and of course Gage is talking to Judd like he's like a sailor. You know, on acid, and Judd confronting him with a cleaver. So I love this image of here's an old man with a cleaver and a toddler with a scalpel. And I love though, this is one of the quintessential Stephen King lines of dialogue that I absolutely love from Judd. Come on and get your pecker out then, whatever you are. We'll see who fucks with who. Which is uttered to a toddler holding a scalpel. I'd like to reiterate that point, just in case that the subtlety of that has been missed.
This is the kind of thing that he really excels at, right? These scenes, like these set pieces right here that would not work on the screen. This is like, these are some reasons why a lot of King's work does not translate well to the big screen or to any screen is because of moments like this that are so over the top and crazy that they only work inside your own head. And even then you're like, what am I reading?
Exactly.
Right
though, like, I will tell you, I'd have gone back and seen that movie multiple times in the theater if I could have watched Fred Gwynn say, come on and get your pecker out.
There's so many things that kept that movie from achieving greatness. It was so close. It was close in so many ways, but it fell short for obvious reasons. But yes, I completely agree with you. And then hearing the toddler voice saying, I'll fuck with you all I want. Like, as he's
exactly
slashing, all I want in this little baby voice as he's destroying this old man. And then, dear God, right? Oh. So Rachel, poor Rachel. And by this point, we've been given the full scoop on Zelda, her sister, and how she died. And that's another part of the movie that lives in my nightmares, by the way, that whole thing. And she is carrying that very closely in her heart, right? And you feel that in her POV portions of the book. When she pulls up to the house, she immediately knows something is wrong. She goes inside and she hasn't found Judd's body. And I don't think she doesn't quite, because she's led upstairs. She sees the cat. I think Church, the cat, is already there because he's sort of like the familiar in this situation. Like, he's got his, you know, he's part of this whole thing too. And so I think she follows Church upstairs, but she hears like a mewling sound, like that maybe Judd is in pain. Maybe he fell. She, you know, because he's an old man. So she thinks, oh my God, he's hurt. She races up the stairs, but she also sees footprints that are the size of Gage's feet. And immediately, like, that kind of hits her. She opens the door and immediately thinks she sees Zelda, her sister. She's having some perception issues, like, what, you know, she's not sure what she's seeing. But then all of a sudden she realizes it's not Zelda who's bent and twisted and coming back from the grave to kill her, what she had feared most of her life. It's Gage. And she sees him coming toward her and saying, I have something for you, mommy. I have something for you. And she holds her arms out because it's her little boy. And then that's it. We don't see what happens beyond that. And until Lewis is back in the picture. This is like, oof, getting through this. Lewis wakes up then. Like, it's perfect timing, right? Because at this point, Judd's dead, and so is Rachel. And all that's left right now is the cat and Gage. But Lewis knows immediately. Like, he wakes up almost like he has a bad hangover. Whatever madness had overtaken him the night before, it's almost like it's gone out with the tide just a little bit for a moment, and it allows him that moment of clarity when he sees the footprints in the bedroom and the medical bag open. He already knows what's happened. Deep in his heart, he knows that what has come back is not his little boy. And so he very methodically sets about getting the syringes, goes across the street, sees Church the cat sitting on top of the car, whatever. He taunts him over, like, or gets him over with some food. And then when the cat starts to eat, he shoves a morphine syringe into the cat's back, and immediately gonzo. Church is gone. And you could just feel him, like, going more and more through this tragic metamorphosis of realization. And he also sees the rental car. I don't think he quite tied it to Rachel
yet, though. Yeah, he's not connected with Rachel. I do have to have, if you haven't figured it out by now, I'm going to have a side point here just for a second. What are the circulatory system for zombies in this? Which is essentially what we're dealing with. I mean, I feel like
that's true.
I thought about this, you know, I can't remember if King ever discusses if these things have heartbeats again or what.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I almost feel like they do have a heartbeat, because if I recall, when he does kill Gage again, he listens. He says the last act he ever did as a doctor was putting that stethoscope up
and listening. Right. Okay.
So I think there is definitely like a full reanimation of the body in the physiological sense. So that's a very good question, though, because that morphine has to get where it needs to go. And, you know, these are dead people essentially, but I think they're literally brought back to life. Just
could you imagine how horrific as a Romero movie would have been if that's how you had to get rid of every zombie? So
dear God.
Walking Dead wouldn't have made it to episode two.
The rules of returning the dead to life, that brings back, it's like, okay, what's been established in lore? It's like the same with vampires, right? Like, do vampires breathe? What's going on with vampires? Yeah. But yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because I hadn't even thought of that moment with the stethoscope until you mentioned it. And that ended up being sort of like a cap off because part of me feels like I have forgotten some things that are only brought back by certain triggers. Because I do know that once Lewis goes in and he finds Judd dead and he covers him up with a tablecloth, I believe it was, from the dining room. And, you know, he has his grief moment because in many ways, Judd is like his surrogate father because Lewis's father died when Lewis was quite young. And so he even said in the very beginning of the book that he met the man who should have been his father. And so the bond between these two has just always been very paternal. And when he goes upstairs, he still doesn't realize until he finds Rachel. And this is the part that always gets me, is the way that King doesn't really quite describe it. When he decides not to describe something in detail, that's your permission to assume it's way, way, way,
way worse.
Worse
than what you could ever have imagined.
Yeah, because when he sees Rachel and really sees her, the only description I recall is that he said it looked like something had been at her. And that's it. That's really all we get until we can then put the link together when he finally does see Gage and Gage's face is covered in blood. So we got a little cannibal going on here too. Little zombie man. In addition to him wielding a scalpel. And the fact that he did that to the mother, you know, it's just, to me, that's just really talks about the evil, the blameless person in all of this, you know, other than Ellie and of course Gage himself, the most innocent people in this story really get hit the hardest. And that's when Lewis uses whatever remaining sliver of sanity he has left to do the right thing, and that is to kill Gage again. And it's not too much of a battle, I think, because it's already just hard enough. He's been through enough. He manages to overcome the kid pretty easily. But the saddest part is that as Gage is dying, he kind of comes back for, like, the real Gage comes back for a second, and then he's gone. So, of course, it's just that final cap off.
I reread the book before we recorded, and I realized that whole sequence, I mean, from the resurrection or whatever, I mean, all of that is so tightly done. I mean, it really is like 10% of the book.
It's one of the reasons I think why I came back to it so many times, other than being obsessed with it, because it is one of those that it doesn't force you to sit through too much exposition and everything before it really starts handing out the dividends.
I mean, there's, viscera, but so much of this is emotional horror. So much of it is that emotional damage. And just that entire middle section when Gage is, after Gage is killed, and the emotional damage that's done to Lewis and to Rachel, and Lewis starts losing his grip and everything. So much of that is so difficult to get through that by the time you get to this final battle at the end, the boss battle, so to speak, if King had stretched it out much more, oh my God, it would have been it would have been overkill. It would have been too much.
Yeah, it would have been way too much. And it would have been, I think, absurd in the way of watching Judd have his showdown with Gage. And that felt very much like a mano-a-mano kind of, I know you, you know me kind of thing. Whereas this is definitely playing out like the ultimate tragedy here. But I think when Lewis sees what happens to Rachel, I think that's pretty much, that's the end of him, as we know. And the book more or less, it doesn't end yet because it kind of cuts away. Again, we have another person who comes out of left field because at this point we're running out of players. They're like part of this because they're all dead. And so one of Lewis's colleagues from the campus, very concerned about Lewis after everything that happened with Gage, he's coming around the corner to like basically a welfare check on Lewis and finds... I think isn't oh the because Lewis burned down
yeah, Lewis Judd burned Crandall's house on everything and sets it all on fire.
So yeah, he comes around the corner, sees a house burning, and then he eventually sees a flash of white coming from the path behind Lewis's house, and he decides to follow. And this is also just such a chilling moment because as he pursues Lewis, he follows him all the way to the pet cemetery, and he sees that the flash of white is not only that Lewis is carrying the sheet wrapped bundle of Rachel in his arms, his hair is also turned white, which I think is another brilliant kind of cosmic horror touch there. Lewis is completely lost his mind. And Lewis is talking to him very conversationally about this. He's like, oh, it didn't work out with Gage, but I waited too long with Gage. Rachel, you know, she just died a minute ago. So I know if I just get her up there real quick that, you know, it'll be okay. And Steve, the guy, he's like, what the hell?
If I pop her, strikes him at the ground really fast, it'll all be good. Really?
Yeah. Because everything else up to this point so well. Has been. And then he hears a mad cackling howl after he watches again Lewis gracefully defying gravity, descending this deadfall and going down the other side. He hears this lunatic howl cackle from deep in the woods on the other side. And that guy says, you know what? I'm out of here. And he just busts tail out and actually never comes back to that town.
But he does have that moment where like, Lewis is asking him. You know, I could really use, you know, I don't have any tools. I could really use some help getting her on the ground. And Steve thinks, you know, I would like to help him. I would like to know what is going to happen here, which is the power of that ground seeping into him. But I think Steve was still emotionally distant enough. This isn't anyone dead that he loves. He's still able to break away from that.
What might he be thinking about later on in his life? I've sometimes put my head in the mind of someone who's seen something like that and somehow got away, and how, you know, you probably never think about it until those moments when you're trying to fall asleep at 2 o'clock in the morning and your brain just decides, hey, I'm just going to put this intrusive, awful thought in your head that you can just ruminate on as you're trying to sleep.
Well, instead of that, remember when your former colleague was carrying his dead wife to barrier and into a Native American, a cursed Native American soil. You remember that?
Yeah. Remember that moment? Whatever happened to that guy, I wonder, right? And that's the end of the main story until we get an epilogue, which I think is honestly probably one of the best epilogues ever written in anything. A lot of times epilogues don't feel necessary, but this one absolutely was necessary. And I think doesn't really bring a whole lot of closure, but it definitely brings that additional horror stamp as we have Lewis with his completely ruined hands because he's been digging up in that very stony soil, you know, for however long it took to bury Rachel. And then it's almost like he knows. And so he's playing solitaire and he's just having thoughts. And then he flips over, I think it was the Queen of Spades. And that's when he hears the door open and he smells what's coming and a cold hand lands on his shoulder and he hears this icy voice and she says, darling.
And then the Ramones start playing, which is really weird for a book.
The Ramones. And that's a good point. You know, the Ramones had a very good attachment to King because they wrote a song specifically for the movie after knowing
one of the best-selling songs, fantastic.
Yeah. It was such a great little kinship there. And Stephen King has had a bit of a background with some rock and rollers, you know, because he had a pretty good relationship with AC/DC whenever he made Maximum Overdrive. You know, they wrote a good bit of the soundtrack for that movie as well. So there's something about Stephen King and rock and roll that
Stephen
just,
King
you
was
know, goes
where I
together.
first found out about LCD sound systems because he talked about them so much in Under the Dome.
Yes. Oh my God. I need to return to that one. That is an
And I'm just
epic
going to say,
of all
you
epics
have to
there.
be incredibly uncool to find out about a hip techno band from Stephen King.
It's interesting. His taste in music, and you know, he's owned a radio station for a very long time. So it's interesting the music that
Yeah.
he gets into as a result of that. Now, this is a good segue, though, to talk about the movie. And we're just going to talk about mostly about the one directed by Mary Lambert, or 1988. It stars Fred Gwynne, of course, as Judd. I can never remember the name of the actor that plays
Dale Midkiff.
Lewis. Dale
I
Midkiff,
hate that I
thank
know
you.
that.
I will say it's funny if you look at Dale's face, he does kind of like have the look that I would imagine of Lewis Creed from the book. He's just your standard
He's your
average
standard
white
80s
guy.
hairsprayed bohunk.
That
I
okay,
mean,
yes.
he just looks like the human embodiment of a bowl of tapioca pudding.
That is brilliant. Are you a writer? Because man,
Some would argue,
I love
no, I
it.
am not, but that's besides the
No,
point.
oh my God. But you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's really, that was a good depiction of the family as a whole that way. You know, they kind of do all have that
Oh
waspy
yeah, Denise.
American family
It was
look
Denise
going on.
Crosby, right? Denise Crosby, who plays
Yeah.
Rachel. And this was post that like half season or so of Star Trek Next Generation she had got.
It was kind of interesting seeing her in this role because I think of her kind of more as like a badass type character. So this role felt like a shift a little bit because Rachel, well, I wouldn't say that she's like a wilting violet type. She's got a lot of fragility going on for reasons. And so I thought that was an interesting choice for casting for Rachel, although looks wise, I think she nails it, and of course she's a great actress. So, and then of course Fred Gwynne as Judd, which to me I can't undo that in my brain. Like that's just Judd Crandall, you know. No disrespect to John Lithgow, who was in the remake, and I absolutely love his work, but I still feel like that's Fred Gwynne's role. He just
Oh,
nails that
completely.
accent. He nails the look.
I
It's
always, I've
just that
always
is
said,
Judd.
and I've made this argument for years, and I haven't updated this list, this idea really since It, since the two It films. But my contention has always been that this was for a long time. Again, I've, you know, because like, I think like a Stephen King movie came out since we started recording this. That
Yeah.
great performances in Stephen King films are in order. Morgan Freeman, Fred Gwynne, and Kathy Bates.
Oh, you nailed it
You know,
completely.
I
Completely.
always think that Gwynne gets it over Bates because she had a better script, a better director, and better co-stars to work with, whereas Gwynne was just
Yeah.
out there, you know, paddling that canoe by himself.
You are so correct. I couldn't have said it better myself. And in many ways, it does feel like his movie. I feel like without him, this movie would have really had no mooring. It would have had no soul. And I think that's really what makes it kind of redeemable. But I will say, here's what I feel like the movie gets correct. I feel like it nails the horror aspects, the
Yes.
Victor Pascal parts. Very scary. The atmosphere in the woods, really well done. And
Oh
the
my God,
Zelda
the Zelda
sequences.
sequences are horrific.
So rewinding back to my 12-year-old-ish self, or however old I was when I read this, I was quite young, but I immediately had to go out and rent the movie But I didn't have anywhere to watch it because my mom wouldn't let me watch it. But I was a babysitter. And so I had an opportunity after I did a babysitting stint, after the kids went to bed, to put this thing in and watch it. I was so obsessed with this story at the time, and I was not prepared for some of those little moments that like live in your head. And it was mainly the Zelda stuff. And also when Lewis, after he unburies Gage in the cemetery and takes him into the woods, those little moments there that kind of stick with me, because what the movie misses is the emotional weight aspect.
Exactly. It is so like, because I rewatched it last week because I commit completely to a project.
I appreciate that very much.
And
Thank you.
so like I rewatched it last week, and it was just, it's so interesting because because King wrote the script for this thing. And
Oh, he
yeah,
did. Okay, that's
he
even
wrote
more
the script. And
interesting.
here's what's interesting. So because I also watched a making of a documentary about the making of and the legacy of Pet Sematary, the movie, which is only actually, that documentary is 5 minutes shorter than the movie itself, which
Oh, wow. Did you find that on
it
YouTube,
is
by the way?
on
Is that where you?
Tubi. Yeah, it is on
Oh,
Tubi for
okay.
free, as it should be, because it definitely overstates, I think, the legacy of what that movie is. Like they talked to like every fucking person in Maine that might have been tangentially connected. Like they talked to like
What?
one of his former neighbors of the house that he was living in when he came up with the idea for the book. And because there was a pet cemetery, he took the spelling of pet cemetery from the pet cemetery that was close to the house. They were talking to
Oh,
like a
wow.
groundskeeper for like an actual, official cemetery that was in the area. But it was, it's interesting because when you watch the movie, you don't get that. I mean, like, you don't get that emotional connection with it. You don't get the connection with Judd and Lewis, which I think is really key to it.
Oh, it's because I feel like Dale Midkiff is so aloof in it,
Oh,
right?
he's
It's
the
just
dullest
you
eye
don't get the
human being
sense
I've
that he
ever
could,
seen.
you don't get the sense that he could
No,
bond with
no. Little
anything.
trivia that I found out. When they were casting for the movie, they wanted Keith Carradine. And at another
Oh,
point,
huh.
and this is, of course, this is what gets categorized as half-assed internet research. There was a point where they wanted to cast Bruce Campbell. There is no world whatsoever where this movie is not made 100% better with Bruce Campbell playing Lewis Creed.
I want it now. I
Like
want
the
this
goal of
movie.
time travel should be solely to
Yes.
go back and put Bruce Campbell in this movie.
Honestly, I feel like that is so brilliant that people just didn't like I never would have thought of
But
it, but
King
it's
had
so
written the
brilliant.
script, and then like the screenwriters went on strike, and studios were looking for stuff that they could film that didn't need to get rewritten, and they had the script, and so they pulled it together. Studio didn't want to have a gap in releases coming up, but you never get the connection, you never get the emotional connection with Judd and Lewis, which is sorely missing. Rachel is a little fragile, well, by a little, I mean a lot. But it's balanced out because just like I think you pointed that out, that Denise Crosby has that natural sort of toughness to her, and it balances against
Yes.
sort of the way that King, who is probably not maybe the greatest adapter of his own material, the way
No.
he wrote that. I always felt the loss of Norma. Norma is not a character, Judd's wife, not a character in the book, I mean in the
Right.
movie. But above all
Right.
things, though, man, Fred Gwynne, just every scene in that movie, Fred Gwynne owns. He is just so iconic in that.
He really is. And I also feel like, given King's aversion to this book on an emotional level for him, like he wrote this thing, he didn't have any intention of publishing it. It scares him too much. He still haunts him to this day. I honestly feel like he was not in the right emotional place to write this screenplay. I feel like we almost needed someone more detached on an emotional level from the work itself, because it feels like King just did an emotional shorthand with these characters in this, like he just turned off that part of his brain when he was writing the script. And the whole weight of this book rests on those relationships and those emotional connections. And that's honestly why I think it's so easy to open up and empathize and really feel like you can relate to every horrible decision. Because here's the thing, like horror as a genre is filled with the most annoying tropes on the planet. That is the one genre that when you watch it on the screen, when you're watching events play out, you are usually yelling at the screen, "Don't do that. What are you doing? You're such an
Oh my
idiot."
God,
You
she got
know?
sick.
But
She's
in
not going to
this,
live long.
exactly. Like there's so many things. But this one, you're seeing the characters make the most horrible decisions, but you're watching in complete, like, horrified silence because you're thinking, yeah, they're doing a horrible thing, but I understand why, and I might end up doing the same myself. Oh my God, this is terrifying. It's really like a complete inversion of the tropiness of horror. So King really shouldn't have written that script, and I had completely forgotten he did, but now that I know that he did, it actually makes complete sense why the movie falls a little flat, because I feel like the things that were great in the overall flawed movie were not from the script, but were from the collaborative efforts of the art direction, the director, and some of the editing choices that were made in it. You know, those
How
more
much of the movie,
atmospheric
I mean,
things.
when you think about it, less than the book is less than 400 pages, and really the most horrific stuff is in the last third. And not even the last
Yes.
third. I mean, like so much of it is the last 10, 15% of the book. And so much of it
Yeah.
then is establishing those relationships, conversations with Judd. And we're finding out about Rachel's backstory. I mean, there are a couple of things that the movie does, does do well, because I like Pascal, how they bring him in as a character more and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and the Timmy Baderman flashback was pretty good too. I think they showed just enough of that to make it terrifying without showing too much of Timmy. Because I think also it's another one of those things from the book that's kind of like when Timmy is talking to Judd and his friends and saying the things that he's saying. That's another moment that plays really well on the page that probably would be comedic on the screen. So they kind of wisely left some of that out and just made Timmy into more of a shambling zombie
I
type.
found interesting that King made the decision, and so like in the movie, they portray it as like Judd was among these young men who went and burned the house down with Timmy and the dad in it. In the book, it's Timmy, the dad kills Timmy and then himself. Yeah, so that was a really interesting choice to like for the movie to make to really and not a terrible choice, honestly, to make Judd part of what had happened all those years ago, as opposed to just having that one that the secret exposed about him going to a brothel, and then like nothing, and then the house burns down like, 2 days later.
We have to talk too. I mean, the most fatal flaw of the film, which is weird, well, not weird, it's understandable, but it also shares what makes the book so terrifying. But it also demonstrates the problems of adaptation. The most fatal flaw in the film is Gage, because of the limitations that naturally are presented when you have a 2 or 3 year old. Or I think the actor playing him at the time, he was like 3 and a half or something like that, but he was very young, like a very young child. And there's only so much acting that you can get out of someone that young, and so much screen time you can get out of someone that young. And the makeup, you know, you can't do the things with makeup and practical effects using a child of that age that you can out of someone who is a little older, which was why the 2019 remake had it so that Ellie was the one who got killed, so that they could utilize an older child for
which also those parts. Misunderstands so much of what makes the story horrifying.
Yes, agreed, agreed. And so that's a hard workaround, and I'm not even sure if they remade it today that it would quite, you would almost have to have a CGI kid.
Oh, completely.
Because I don't know. I mean, it, but, and, you know, things get are convincing enough nowadays that I feel like they could probably make it work, but you would need a hell of a budget to pull that off, which is why I think, oh, if you get Guillermo del Toro to do it, then maybe that'll work. And he would shoot it and frame it in a way that would be even more terrifying, I feel, than what Mary Lambert pulled off, or didn't quite pull off, rather, and this, where Gage just comes back looking like a normal ass 2-year-old with a little scar down his forehead because he's so cute. It's like,
we'll ignore the fact he got nailed by an 18-wheeler.
Yeah. Let's just completely forget that, and let's just make him look like a, like just a sweet, and I can understand possibly the decision that maybe that's disturbing in its own way to just see this bright-eyed, sweet, cute little kid, you know, running around like, you know, all dangerous like, but it's just the kid was hamming it up so much because he's 3. I mean, what are you going to do to tell a 3-year-old? You really need when to tap into your motivation.
And he's like growling or something, and he's got like his little teeth bared and everything. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. A flaw with the movie is so much of it is like, we're rushing through stuff. We have to hurry and rush through stuff so we can get to zombie toddler.
Yes. Even the death scene moment, it was really shortcut. I mean, exactly. It's just, you see this like some photo shoots of like, here he's born and Lewis just screaming no over and over again. And it just felt so shortcut. And then all of a sudden we're at this funeral scene that was, again, it felt kind of cheap and shoddy. It lacked all of that internal dialogue, which you're never going to get. But it even normally you express those internal emotions on your face. But Dale Midkiff is not that kind of an actor.
Dale Midkiff has never expressed anything in his life. I have seen greater frustration standing in a line at Starbucks when someone found out they were out of soy milk. I mean, dude, your kid was just turned into road pizza. And no, I'm not buying it at all.
I'm not buying it. And yeah, completely wrong part for him. He should have really just been the cameo of the truck driver. Maybe that, you know, that probably would have been the better role for him. Again, they just blow right past these things. And so, yeah, it felt cheated. It didn't want to like kind of sit with those really uncomfortable emotions. And there were probably also budget limitations. Oh, I'm sure there were other things. But I mean, ultimately, I feel, as I do with a lot of these stories, that if they did get readapted, well, honestly, I think Pet Sematary doesn't need to be a series, although I feel like a limited series, maybe like 5 episodes, something like that, just to give it a little room to breathe.
If someone was digging up a grave and planting someone into the soil back there, and chaos and mayhem ensued, hijinks ensued every week.
I'm a little surprised that hasn't really been considered, because the setting and everything around that, the secrets of the people who live in that town and the people, possible outsiders coming in. I mean, my God, you could build world really around that patch of land. And I feel like it would be so interesting to explore it almost in the way, and this is bringing in another Stephen King story. I don't know if you've read Needful Things, but I feel like that's another story that lends itself so well to the idea of like a TV series. It centers around something happening in that locale. This is a weird side note,
but I had this realization the other day, Allison. Did you ever watch the series, mm-hmm. Friday the 13th, the series?
It was one of my favorite shows growing up. I was obsessed with that show.
And so the general premise is an antique store. They're having to get back all the antiques that were cursed by the devil. By the way, I own this show on DVD, all three seasons.
That's how tragic I am.
I realized the other day.
No, you're awesome.
The other day that Needful Things is Friday the 13th, the series in reverse. Instead of them gathering back cursed antiques, it's them selling the cursed antiques.
Exactly. And really taking advantage of the vulnerabilities of the people buying them, because Leland Gaunt just knew like what people needed. And yeah, he's the devil selling the wares to the people. That's a brilliant concept. I'm so glad that you brought up Friday the 13th, the series, because I truly do believe that that show is very instrumental, really, for me as a writer growing up. My Saturday night ritual was Tales from the Dark Side and Friday the 13th, the series, and also the show Monsters, which was like a even lower budget Tales from the Dark Side.
Which is really difficult to imagine being lower budgeted than Tales from the Dark Side.
It truly is. And honestly, all those both of those shows adapted a number of Stephen King's short stories from multiple collections of his over the years. So fantastic. I would love to revisit the Friday the 13th series at some point. I wonder if it's streaming somewhere. Do you know? I know you have it on DVD.
It is not.
Oh, that is very, that is tragic, but because it should it be really on Shudder or something.
I have posted about this. This is really funny. I have posted about this on social media, and every other writer seems to be like, oh my God, I loved that show. Is it on streaming anywhere? And it was on like Prime for a while, and they took it off. And it was it was produced and distributed by Paramount. So it would make sense if eventually it shows up on Paramount Plus.
I agree. And yeah, usually when things like this happen, there's probably some entanglement with a studio and the various rights issues involved. I was recently reading, and this is a tangent, I know, but I was recently reading an article, I think it was, oh, we sure are. We're doing it well, man. Black Mirror, which is another great anthology show. Charlie Booker, the creator of that, that show's been on Netflix for a while, but he, after they ended the last season, he changed production companies, and the old production company still held the old rights to the show that Netflix then had to relicense from them so that then Charlie could start writing for the next season that's upcoming. So it's really interesting to see like why things are delayed or why we're not able to see certain shows and things on streaming properties. And yeah, there's just so many hurdles red tape and things. So I'm hopeful. And now I'm just like maybe wanting to go on eBay and buy a DVD set of that series, because I would willing to do that. I don't have many DVDs left anymore. I don't have a lot of physical media. I've kind of shamefully parted ways with a lot of it over the years, but I would definitely own that set, because like a lot of people, they say, I don't make a lot of room in my collection for this many discs, but I have all my Alfred Hitchcock movies, and I have all, I have all my Lord of the Rings stuff. And then, yeah, I would have that one. But yeah, this movie, I feel like it nailed a lot of points. It missed a lot of points. I guess if I had to average it out, I would give it probably a C+ on a generous day. It's not a terrible movie, but it's not
a good movie. I'm just going to say this. And I think this is, if you have anyone who's watched this movie and they think about this movie, there's one scene that everyone thinks about. And it was wholly generated. I double checked this. It was not in the book. It is in the movie. And I mean, and for,
oh God, oh what my is God, it?
It's when Gage cuts into,
his ankle, the Achilles tendon.
Holy fuck.
Yes.
I will acknowledge I watched that when I watched that again last week, and I was like, oh Christ.
Doesn't he also, or maybe this happened in the book, doesn't he cut across Judd's face and like opens his mouth up more? Or was that from the book, or was that in the movie?
I can't remember how Judd is really described post. But I mean, definitely somewhere I probably still have that issue of Fangoria. with
very
Fred
nice.
Gwynne splayed open, his face splayed open on the cover.
God.
Probably paid four
Oh,
and a
my
half bucks for
Lord.
that.
Yeah, it worth it. I mean, it's funny how we can you can derive so many iconic moments from this movie, or like those shots or certain like things from it. But then, like, yeah, when you put it together and watch it as a whole, it's missing something. And I remember there was also a sequel
With
to the film that
Anthony
came out
Edwards.
some years later.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
Edward
Oh, yeah.
Furlong.
Edward Furlong from poor misbegotten Edward Furlong, who, yeah, it was a
Oh yeah, no, it's
terrible,
awful.
terrible, awful, no good.
I watched it when it came out on video, 30 years ago. It's been 30 years, and I have revisited a lot of terrible movies, and I've never once had any desire whatsoever. And it's got Clancy Brown in it.
No. Yeah, and it's like, wow, they actually got some decent actors in
And
this
Barry
thing,
Lambert directed it.
but yeah, so Mary Lambert, man, she is bound and determined to have her stamp
No kidding.
on this property. And I would say that this definitely falls into the category of a cult movie, in the sense of I think there is definitely a segment of the population that adores this film, but Mary Lambert has done a lot of kind of cult like horror-y stuff. I think she even did a Bloody Mary type movie or show or something like that. And that was many years ago. So I feel like that's just kind of her playground. And I have no problem if they want to bring Mary back, but I feel like she's going to have to really be given a great script and some fantastic actors that kind of let the show run
Yeah,
itself.
yeah. Like let her point the camera and figure it out from that point on. Let things figure themselves out from that point on. It is such a visceral idea. It taps into all of these essential horrors that we have as people, as a species. Like we all, we have this collective idea about the horrificness of losing, of not just of death, but and losing someone we love, but of losing a child. And all of that horribleness that strikes at the heart of us.
I didn't want to let this quote escape before we wrap up our discussion on this, but I feel like the best quote from this book is its hardest lesson. And that quote is, "Sometimes dead is better." And I love what King wrote about this when he did a foreword when the book was re-released back in 2000, or I should say a new printing. He wrote a new introduction for it. And he said, "Perhaps sometimes dead is better is grief's last lesson, the one we get to when we finally tire of jumping up and down on the plastic blisters and crying out for God to get his own cat or his own child and leave ours alone. The lesson suggests that in the end, we can only find peace in our human lives by accepting the will of the universe. That may sound like corny new age crap, but the alternative looks to me like a darkness too awful for such mortal creatures as us to bear." And that harkens again back to those cosmic horror elements. The universe does not care about you. You have to bend with it. And all amount of fighting it and going against it can lead to these very dark and awful places. And we've touched on a lot of that throughout this, the refusal to accept and confront death the way that we should and talk about it the way that we should. It all ties into the themes of the story. And honestly, I hope that anybody walking away from this can have like a healthy meditation on the topic, and I don't know, maybe decide to do the responsible thing and talk to your family about your wishes, and also just kind of go along a journey that kind of gives you an acceptance of your own mortality. Because I feel like we all have to have that conversation and that walk at some point. And it's not easy or fun to do it, usually when you're very old or very sick, or, and sometimes nobody is given that that opportunity. It's too late. Life can be ripped away from you at a moment's notice. It's a bit of a heaviness to end this on, but this is a heavy story. I would say ultimately the heaviest of the stories that we will at least be discussing in this season of the show. But I feel like as far as King's work is concerned, it is by far the darkest and the weightiest of them. I am really glad that you wanted to talk to me about this story. As soon as I saw somebody say, yes, I want to talk about Pet Sematary, I'm like, oh, thank God. Cause I didn't want to let this season pass without talking about this story. Cause it means the world to me.
People will always argue the merits of King, and his work. But I think he, in such a real stark way, he touches upon the themes of death and how we approach it and how we deal with it. And I don't think he's ever done it better than he did with this book. I think it's a meditation on mortality wrapped in, in horror.
Yeah, the deepest, darkest of horror. Actually, I think I'm going to go reread it now. I actually listened to the audiobook a couple of years ago. I was when I did a lot of driving for my job, I noticed that they re-released an Audible and that Michael C. Hall was the narrator, and I immediately knew I had to have it. And so that was my last experience with this book. And I think I need to just dive back into the page, because there's nothing quite like turning that
there
page,
really isn't.
Especially in our ancient dog-eared copies that we both clearly have. My spine is on that book is broken, and it's probably got one more read left in it before it finally falls apart.
This is the copy I have is a hardback, and I think it's a first edition printing of it back from 83. And the pepper on it's a little beat up, but yeah. I'll have that for the rest of my life.
It's well loved. Yeah, and pass it down, just like the secret of the Micmac burial ground. Oh, James, I absolutely loved having you here, and I hope you might join me again on another episode. We'll find something to talk about. James, Gerald's game is waiting for us.
I'd love to dig in on that one, because there is the movie on that also.
Oh, brilliant adaptation, by the way. I think that is probably one of the better ones, and the performances, especially Carla Gugino's performance,
Flanagan is such a great interpreter of King.
Actually, let him do Pet Sematary. All right, Mike Flanagan, hello, here we go. Step into that shoe, please. I trust him completely with anything of King's that he wants to get his hands on. So, but I want you now, James, to tell the listeners here where they can find you online and where they can find your work and what's going on with you currently.
You can most likely find me on Twitter, being a smartass, at James D. F. Hanna. my five Henry Malone books, and there's also a standalone that takes place in that sort of a shared universe. All six of those books are available through all of your various electronic booksellers, and can be ordered through bookshop.org, so they can be procured at your finest independent bookstore. Please support your independent bookstores. I have Amen. Upcoming a, let's see here, I've got a story and an anthology edited by Lawrence Block coming out later this year. That's called, the story's called Knock, and it's in an anthology called Playing Games that should be out June or July. And that thing's just stacked with amazing writers. S.A. Cosby's in it, Gar Anthony Haywood.
Nice.
Todd Goldberg, David Morrell, Jeffrey Deaver. I can't believe they let me in.
I understand completely.
And then in November, my story, No Man's Land, it was selected as a story for Best American Mystery and Suspense 2022. And I know that story will be in there with also some stories by folks like Todd Goldberg, Hector Acosta, again, F.A. Cosby, just really legitimately some of the best crime writers out there. But that story originally appeared in an anthology of crime fiction. It was called Only the Good Die Young, Crime Fiction Inspired by the Songs of Billy Joel. That story was based off of a song from Joel's most recent rock album, which I think was River of Dreams around like 93 or so. So I'm really, and for reasons I can't figure out, they let a guy from Kentucky write about the mafia and real estate in Long Island in 1992. So,
okay, listen, some of the best knowledge of and work about crime and mafia comes from the South. I'm so happy for you, by the way, just seeing the good stuff that's happening for you professionally and very, very well deserved. And I was so excited when you wanted to come on here and talk with me. I'm the one that feels like, you know, I'm not doing anything right now. I'm just kind of vibing through life, and I need to get back on the writer horse. So really getting to talk to you guys.
We need you cranking stuff out. Come on. Come hang out with,
I know.
With the cool kids and also me. Come on.
Yes. You got a date. We are going to make it happen. I mean, we don't live too far apart, so I feel like we could definitely do like a, you know, a convention of sorts in the Appalachian country, me being this Ohio gal.
Which I've never held against you, I'd like to point out.
Thank God. I mean, I do apologize all the time for it.
Thank you for having me on.
I will see you on social media, and everybody out, go and read your books. And I personally, Allison Dixon, will see the rest of you on another episode of Ding Dong Darkness Time. If you have any questions about our discussion here, you can reach out to me on Twitter at @DDDarknessTime. You can also email me DDDarknessTime@gmail.com. Please hop on over to Apple and give the show a rating and a review. It really boosts the visibility of it, you know, or just recommend it to your friends. I really appreciate all the support, and I will see you all next time. Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.